So perhaps
Then was, I think it was virtually essential to read certainly the Financial Times, because conditions might have changed. In pre-war, you always had suspicion Hitler might be walking into another country over the weekend when everybody else was paying no attention. You would find company news in it, and you get a sort of an overall picture of the financial. Then one would probably have a quick look at, funnily enough, in those days, I think one used to look more at the Mail and the Express rather than the Telegraph to see whether anything had been tipped or there were any snippets of news. And I think it is quite a few jobbers. When you walked onto the floor of the old house, it had a strange atmosphere, apart from the fact that the waiters used to water over it to prevent the dust rising and so on. But it did have an atmosphere, and you could very often feel how the market was going to develop. You then, the books, when one was as a blue button, you brought the books into the house as a dealer. Mm. You expected the books to be there when you arrived. You would check through them, look at any limits that you ought to take action on in the light of your morning's thought on the on your journey in.
Could you explain the limit? What do you mean by limit?
Sorry?
What do you mean by limit? You
would in those days, you had a jobbing book opened. The right-hand side, you would have the actual bargains done, bought and sold. On the left-hand side, you would have limits. Now, if the price was 13.39 in old money, you might have a limit that somebody wanted to buy them at 13.4 halfpenny. So if you arrive, you would have a picture of people who wanted to deal in stock, or somebody had asked a price and size. You'd put his name in the middle. You didn't know what he wanted to do, but during the course of the day, if the price moved, you would try and open him up and find out what he wanted to do to his business. So if you had a buyer at 13.4 and you bought some stock overnight, 13.3 in the market looked a bit dicey, right, offer them at 13.4 and you'd alter your price, not only to yourself, because you might be out and somebody would pick up the book and make the wrong price, you alter the price in the jobbing book, 13.7, shall we say. So you went through that, and then you might get a telephone call from a broker. Otherwise, the brokers would come in.
About what time of day would they?
This would be at 9:30.
Yes.
They would. You then, their blue buttons, which are the same. They could come into the house, run messages, and also they used to check prices for their and report them back to the to their office or to their dealers on the floor. So they used to run through the prices with them. And then hopefully the day's business would start with brokers coming up and asking the price. Sometimes they were obviously just asking the price and didn't have any business. Other times you could feel that they had an order. So half the skill was then finding out that and getting to them to be willing to deal. If the price didn't suit them, you could change your price. And that went on. If you were busy, the idea of sort of going out for a cigarette or a drink or a coffee, in my view, was difficult because you'd lose a thread. Because it very often you didn't know the prices other people were making, or probably didn't. And you would make a price, and you'd see by the expression on the broker's face that it was very different elsewhere. And he was shooting off to deal with somebody, so you knew your price needed adjusting.
Yes.
And, of course, the actual dealing was always interesting. People who knew were always going to spruce you. The people who genuinely wanted to help, and you did business with them. And you'd help them because they'd help you the next day. And oddly enough, only a few years ago, when I'd gone up to the city, and I was stopped by a chap who was certainly more than middle-aged, and he said, "Oh, nice to see you." And I looked slightly blank, and I did recognize him. He said, "I'll never forget the first time I came to you. First day I was a dealer, and I asked you a price, and you said, well, I haven't seen you before, do you want a deal? And so I said, yes, you said, and you said, well, we'll say 13.39 again. And you said, well, if you want to buy them, I'll sell them to you at 13.3. And if you want to sell them, I'll give you 13.9 for them. So your first bargain at least will be a good one. And you said, I will always remember that. Well, because you can't imagine something like that happening nowadays with the only working on the screens and so on. And I think that, Kane also, which is an interest, there was, people criticised the old boy in that a great deal, but it did have a lot to be said for it. There was a lot of give and take in those days. There was one very interesting occasion, I'm sure it must have happened very often, not very often, but a number of other times, but there was a very decent firm of brokers, and respectable, honest, and so on. And they had been very, very badly let in, and quite a size of money for those days, by a client. And they had enough sense to go to the Bank of England and say, well, this has happened. And the bank said, all right, well, okay, just carry on for the moment. And I don't know quite whether the bank approached or, but it then became known to the institutions if they could channel some business through this firm for the next month or so, it would be appreciated. No question, it was done. And I happened to know that because I had some running business with a broker, and I went to see him to deal, and he said, well, I haven't got the order. So I said, oh, so he said, well, I think if you go and see so-and-so, they may have some business. So it was done like that, and there was a great deal of genuine goodwill, provided you had a good reputation, you were known as clean, people would help you. I think that's certainly so too with Esmond Erlacher, who, although was a rival of our firm, did a tremendous amount of help to jobbers who got positions out of place and so on. So that there was that great goodwill, which I fear has evaporated, and I suppose it was, as for the stock exchange in those days, you could say it was typically English, and they were run by gifted amateurs. Now it's run by possibly gifted professionals, but it's changed so much character. Mm.
Let's go back to your typical day. Mm. Did you paused at some point for lunch? Did
you? If you had business running, I never didn't worry about it. If there was nothing happening, or when I had a good tour, I see, then I'd go out for lunch. Occasionally you take somebody to lunch, but more often I think in those days one used to slip out for a drink rather than for a lunch if somebody had done you a good turn, or somebody came to the house you hadn't seen for a long time, you sort of go and have a quick drink. But I like to do my drinking sort of at the end of the day, really. Because I always felt, particularly as a jobber, you could miss something if you were, when things were running. But if they weren't, of course, then it's fair enough.
So you would continue dealing?
You would continue dealing then until, I think it was 4:30 in those days. You then sent your books because you reckoned that you would be able to carry all your prices and limits in your memory, if you were any good, sent them up to the house with your blue button or junior dealer. And then you dealt with any phones or people who were still on the floor of the house wanted to deal, and then you went back, checked over your positions. I think too that if you'd been busy, it was very, very good to go over your costs, because if your writing wasn't very good, and your figures weren't very good, and your blue button or thing dealer cast them up, you might have made a mistake, and you'd suddenly find your position was very different from what you thought. I mean, actually, in the ordinary way, really, you turned over the page, you cast the bought and sold bargains up, yes, and put the rough total. So you oughtn't to, but it did occasionally happen that somebody had taken a 1 for a 7 or 5 for a 6 or something like that. And then as far as the dealing side was concerned, that was it. We had tear-out sheets for quite a time, which you... jobbing books change shape quite a lot. And you just tore out the bottom sheet. And as in the sort of later days, when we were getting more efficient, we had computers and so on. They used to go up to the office at various intervals so that the office was sort of keeping up to date. They weren't just getting it, as in the old days, in a rush. Because when I first went there, as a checking clerk, so used to take the bargains, copy them out onto checking sheets, which they took down to the house in the morning, and they used to copy them out from the jobbing book.
Yes.
And then, of course, it meant that everything was sort of happening in a rush, but it was much better when you sent them out every so often. Mm. You just tore them out, and also it was quite useful because and it was then, of course, that one would have partners' meetings. Usually went round the office to talk to people in the office because I think jobbers were much more closely linked with staff, probably, than brokers. Brokers may not agree that, I don't know, but certainly one didn't. You knew how they were getting on and who might be useful in the house and so on. And you would have then partners' meetings, which of course would cover anything from promotion, demotion, outlook, which books ought to be changing their shape.
Yes.
When I say shape, going perhaps from a bull tack to a bear tack,
yes.
Whether more money should be allocated because there was larger business happening in one sector than another, mm. and all that. So that you then did that afternoon, early evening.
And would it just be the broker, the partners at these meetings, or would the dealers be with them also?
No, well, these particular meetings would be partners, but then if you were going to have, you want to put something over, it was very easy. We just had everybody in and said, right, well, we've taken on a very large deal in, you know, XYZ. So at the end of the account, we don't want to borrow too much. We'll come onto money later anyway. So, you know, get your books down if you can before the end of the account. You could say that, or somebody might have some ideas and say, well, there's a grave danger that the tax is going to be increased on petrol, should we say, something like that, or purchase tax on cars. So that's going to have a bad effect. So we ought to watch out for that. I think there's... the sort of meetings. Occasionally you had an odd one, something might happen. I remember one case of a company which was possibly going to get taken over but wasn't doing very well. I suppose in this day and age, if a company's not doing well, it's going to like to be taken over, it does get taken over. But we got stuff with some shares and the report came out afterwards, sort of really quite terrible. For some reason, I mean, normally as a jobber in those days, you sort of, well, it's too bad, but this felt something the matter with it. So we took it up and we discovered that one of the directors, as he left his girlfriend for the night, said, oh, dear, you know, I gave you some shares in this company some time back, sell them tomorrow. So, you know, it was that. You can't imagine those sort of things happening so much nowadays. There was a wonderful company called Colin Allied, and changed its name from Motor Fuel Proprietaries, which was in Ossimouth, which was Ramsay MacDonald's constituency. And the idea was that they could convert coal to to petrol. It was a marvellous idea, and there was a bit of a market made, and then it got quite active. It had no assets or dividend or earnings or anything like that. And a team were invited to go up and see this, went up to the factory, and I believe I wasn't there, but I believe it was really quite funny. They went round, they saw the factory, and there was a big coal burning stuff being fed in, and then there were pipes running from A to B, and various temperature controls. And then at the end, there was valves where the petrol should go. So it started up, and then they're taking around his watch and said, "Oh, well, yes, I think we'd better get back now and have a drink before lunch, and we'll have time to see." So they had an absolute super lunch, and then went back all fairly nicely, thank you. The tap was turned, and out came the petrol. I think what had happened, unfortunately, was that the petrol was in another pipe, not connected with the coal. So that went bust fairly quickly, but they were great, great fun like that.
So what about when would your day end, at the end of the 30s?
I would have thought normally you'd be clear about six-ish. Mm.
Would you have people coming around to the office before then, brokers or journalists?
In the ordinary course way, no. Broker might come round if something special, but in the ordinary way, they do it over the telephone or see them want to move something very urgent, or they might come round or ask you to go round to see them.
Did you ever deal after hours on the phone?
Oh, yes, you could. And there were times if you were really busy, I mean, you continued to deal until nobody wanted you. So you might be dealing at 8 o'clock in the evening. And of course, the Americans, we used to deal in Ford, Ford of England. And then the Americans, of course, would come on. They would start their business, I suppose, about 4 o'clock, I think. And then they would go on later, or they would, I remember before the big Ford takeover, I was going out to play golf on Saturday morning, and the phone rang, and there's a broker, and he said, "Are you going to be in?" So I said, "I'm just going out." He said, "Oh, well, it's a pity, because I'm going to get some business in Fords from America." So I put down the golf clubs and sat there and did quite a bit of business Saturday morning. On Monday morning, there was a rights issue, and a broker that I used to play squash with, and I was playing squash with him on that Sunday. And after that, we were sort of sitting around, and quite a few of the people in the club were clients of his. So he got me making a market, which was highly illegal, I think, in those days, in the new shares of this company that was going to start on Monday morning. So I said, "Well, I can't deal, but I'll take those, and if you get on Monday morning, at the official time, we'll do it." But so we did. So at least I did have a fair idea what the price was that Monday morning. But I think it was a great deal more, obviously much more free and easy.
Well, let's resume the piece that you've prepared. Now, we're at after the war. What did you do during the war? Were you serving, or were you...?
Yes, I was a gunner at ACAC. That's why we were called up early. We went down to... because we went down in 38 to Thames Haven in the oil dumps. We dug out gun pits and so on. Some of them we filled about when the flap was over in 38. Some of them we had to fill in. And some of the other ones were left to be for the owner of the land wanted to keep them for shooting boxes. And of course, went down in 39 at the same spot and dug them out again. Then I was commissioned later on and into a heavy ACAC unit, went to Wales, and then we went overseas to join the, well, 8th Army.
And at the end of the war, you decided to return to the house?
Well, as I say, I had certain doubts about it, but as I say, we had this sort of thrash, and guys all sort of came back, and one fellow, I don't know, because they were very nice firm, and I think really one or two exceptions. It was quite a happy ship, which one obviously tried to build up on. Then when Harry Bishop retired, the head partner came, Howard Taylor, who was, he'd been a first class dealer before the war, but he was ill and he'd had malaria, and so it was a bit of a strain on him when he retired. Ingram Cappin took it over, and then I took it over just before we went allowed to become company get outside. Get outside money. I've got, if I can find, I've got a few notes on that.
What effect did the war have on the house and on the firm? Was it able to continue relatively normally?
I wasn't there, but basically it was very, very sticky to start with. I think that the main thing was that all bargains had to be done for cash and settled, so that it, you know, it cut down the sort of gambling, the risks and so on. But by the latter part, they were making money again, because the competition was not very great. I suppose not long after the war started, it must have been enormous departure from non-territorials and so on into various services. So that it became really, I would have thought, very much a negotiated business, which, because in principle, if you were negotiating business, you merely took a small and reasonable turn. Whereas if you bought or sold stock on your own gambit, you made as much as you could out of it. I remember when we went up for the Office of Fair Trading, they were having an investigation, it was possible, this was some years back, Smith Brothers made an approach to us. And we were investigated by the sort of monopolies. And it was quite unbelievable that their knowledge of the stock exchange, the jobbing system, was absolutely non-existent. And they thought,
they didn't have a clue about jobbing.
And they thought that the quoted price, which is might be 56.61, the 56 was the price that we bought them at, 61 was the price we sold them at, and they couldn't believe that probably the quote, if they'd gone to the broker going for a quote between three jobbers to get the best price, would have ended up something like 58.9, and they thought obviously that we were just coining the money.
Now we can resume the period after the war, and you've returned.
We were then fortunate. We were recruiting some new, young and some first class dealers. In fact, well, I was very fortunate when I became chairman. I think we must have had one of the best dealing teams. There was Ed Puxley, who was had been in submarines and took to the stock exchange like a duck to water. First class organizer. He was managing director, and then he took over from me. Brown Winterflood of Winterflood Securities, Connor Potashnik, who ran the shipping book, and Bob Wade, who came from Phillips and Drew, and one of the, I would have thought, fairly rare people who came from a broker to a jobber and then made a tremendous success of it. So we really had a very fun, we were taken over later on after I'd gone by the county bank.
Yes.
We gave them a first class money making team.
And about what time did these people join the firm?
They were joining
late
in
late 40s, early 50s.
I suppose from the probably from the 60s. They didn't all come as a batch, but they came up through Winterflood came from broking firm Green and Dreyfus. And I think Connor came straight to us. And Potashnik, I think, came straight to us. So the recruiting was, I know we were very fortunate, and they all survived the big bang, but not necessarily, well, not with the team that County had bought. They seemed to have got rid of them. And it's extraordinary way that they did. I think the capital point is something of interest in a partnership, but should we do that? Does that come into your questionnaire later? Will we do that later? Or
well, let's continue working through the material that you've prepared.
Well, that's really, that sort of gives a sort of a picture slightly of the slightly toned down of the infighting that can go on between in a partnership. And I think that really sort of is a general picture, I hope, of sort of life.
Yes. How did your work change when you became a partner?
You became, I suppose, more of a teacher and an organizer than merely working, trying to make money while you're on the floor of the house, and then okayed off your shoulders when you went home, and that was that as a partner. Although I think that probably very sensibly most jobbers didn't take their worries home with them for good or bad. If you were related, you went back feeling happy, but if you were depressed, as I said earlier, you shook it off. The next day there was a new battle and everything might fit into place. Which was one of the exhilarating, I think, parts of life. So certainly, it was not a sort of form of life I think that a lot of people would have liked. In your sort of questionnaire, we've got some of the things that makes a job. And I've emphasised the fact, really, that the connections were not important, although obviously they didn't impede anybody. And we had people like Dick Wilkins, who Wed and then later Wed Durlach, was all tremendous character of racing, and Esmond Durlach, as also a very powerful figure, did a great deal for the reputation of the jobbing system in one of its sort of periodic bad patches.
Did the way you actually went about dealing change terribly much in the post-war period, or in that respect was it very similar to the pre-war stock exchange?
It was getting more professionalized then, but in a smaller way. I think that whereas originally it had been geared much more to servicing clients, family trusts with a certain amount of institutional business, you were finding that the individuals were tending to certainly liquidate and either go into trusts or they needed the money or they were operating less. But the actual style of jobbing wasn't, and broking was not very different. That your sums, of course, became large, and they became larger with decimalisation, which was, I suppose, one of the things that saved the jobbers when they were going through a fairly difficult period, because the prices that we quoted and dealt at were far too close on the whole, such was the competition, to be really commercially viable. And the decimalisation made it that easier, that if you were quoting a tuppenny price of in old money, and I thought, well, no wonder everybody wants to tell you to forget the change into the old, just think in the new, You realise, of course, that a twopenny price in the new money was fivepence. The quotes, and you couldn't really quote much closer than a penny or twopenny price in the higher stock, so your margins were automatically become that much more realistic. Mm-hmm. He was still deal inside and sort of half point inside and so on, but it was a great help that time.
And as a partner, did you try and pursue particular policies for the firm after the war?
I think that we were still after the war. We went into partnership. We're still junior partners. I took over the unfortunate time when the market's very bad, and I took over the outgoing partners or part of somebody when I bought my partnership piece. I bought also with it the taxation attached to it, and said that I was, although as a partner, I was deeper into debt as it were than before. So that took a bit of time to pay off. But after that, and the markets became better, and one did get the odd reasonable year,